Welcome to the Cutter's Notch Podcast, a program created by Michael DeCamp, the author of Abandon Hope, a Cutter's Notch novel. Recorded in the Cutter's Notch Studios, this podcast is focused on all things creative, with special forays into books and matters of faith. Join Michael as he catches up with an author, a songwriter, a painter, a comedian, or anyone working or supporting a creative endeavor. So turn up the volume, listen, and catch up on what's happening in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode number 18 of the Cutter's Notch podcast. I'm Michael DeCamp, your host, and with me is...
Nancy DeCamp.
The hostess with the mostest.
Yep.
Yes, and we're still stuck in the pandemic shut-in status.
Yes.
By the time this is broadcast at the end of April, hopefully we're looking at the other end of this and be close to going back to the regular world. But right now, it's just the two of us most of the time, 24/7.
24/7.
Yeah, and we still like each other.
We do. That's been an encouraging thing to realize.
So I hope everyone out there is doing well. We're still separated from our kids, which means that my normal co-host, Angela DeCamp, is still unable to join me on the podcast. However, today, I was playing around with the system, figured out how to Bluetooth my phone in.
So you guys can be back on track, right?
Yeah, so even if we're still sequestered on the next episode, Angela should be back via phone. So
awesome.
It may just be the two of us chatting, but hey, we'll be back together. I wanted to cut a couple of the things out there. This week, I finished a short story, which is going to be in a collection of short stories that I'm going to release for sale this coming summer. I'm not sure what the title of the actual collection is going to be, but it's basically a Cutter's Notch tale. There's going to be at least three of them in there, maybe four, but right now there's three.
That's fun.
And the one today, or the one that I finished this week, is the title of it is Rose and the Wooden Box.
I can't wait to read it. You've given me a copy to read.
Yeah, she gets an advanced copy. That's what happens when you're married to me. You get advanced copies.
Yeah.
But the story behind this one, it started with we were just kind of joking around with this young girl that is in our church small
group.
Her mother is in our church small group.
She's an adopted daughter of...
Yes.
We claim her.
We claim her as an adopted daughter. Her name is Cherie, and she's in her 20s. But we were all sitting around the table one evening, and I said, Cherie, what would you do?
And then the evening went from there.
Yes. Yes, and it all evolved into this short story called Rose in the Wooden Box. And Cherie does show up as a character in the
really?
Story.
Oh, so. I can't wait to see that show up.
Yeah, it'll be. It's. I hope you enjoy it. So I did that this week. I've also, when we talk about books, I usually share about a book, right? Well, for the last several weeks, I've been telling you about the fact that I'm still stuck on Dune. Well, I'm still stuck on Dune.
It's a big book.
It is a big book, but I am finally really into it. I am about halfway through.
Well, you're more than halfway from that little tab.
Well, there's 800.
Not much more, but you are more than halfway.
There's 884 pages, and I'm at page number 458.
You are.
Yes.
Just slightly more.
By the time I record another episode, I'll be done with this. But I wanted to share my favorite line from this whole book so far.
You got a favorite line?
I do. I have a favorite line. And check this out. It's on page 456, at least in my copy.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, in quotation marks, it's somebody speaking. It says, "Do as she says, you worm-faced, crawling, sand-brained piece of lizard turd."
Okay.
"Do it or I'll help her dismember you. Can't you see the worth of this woman?" But I just thought,
okay,
that was such a creative string of descriptions. I just loved it. So I had to share that with everybody.
What page is that on? What page number?
It was just a page back from where I was.
Okay. So,
about halfway through the book. So it was good. It was fun. It was it's going to be a pretty interesting story. So anyway,
good.
I'm a sand faced worm, something or other turd, piece of turd.
Well, not as long as you recognize her worth.
Well, I recognize your worth.
Well, so. See, then you're not all those things.
Tell us about your book.
Well, I just picked up a couple weeks ago and just read the first chapter this last week, a book by Barbara Kingsolver called Flight Behavior. Now, I have read Kingsolver before. She actually has written one of my favorite books called The Poisonwood Bible. And the style of writing and how she does it was phenomenal. I read another one of hers and I was like, yeah. And then a friend of mine that I had grown up with said, oh, no, she's got one. This is my most favorite one. Flight Behavior is my most famous one or favorite one. So I downloaded it and started reading it. And it's the little blurb on it is the woman's name is of the main character is Della Robbia Turnbrough, is a 28-year-old discontented housewife living with her poor family on a farm in Appalachia. On a hike to begin an affair with a telephone repairman, Turnbrough finds millions of monarch butterflies in the valley behind her home.
Millions?
Millions. Ooh. As the news of her discovery spreads, university professor Ovid Byron arrives to study the monarchs and warns that although they are beautiful, they are a disturbing symptom of global climate change, displaced from their established winter habitat in Mexico, and that they may not survive the harsh Tennessee winter. So I have read the first chapter and she experiences the butterflies and the first chapter kind of freaks her out.
So far you like it.
It has my attention at the moment.
Okay.
Which within the first chapter, that's something usually a lot of times there's books you have to read, you know, a couple of chapters to really, for it to really, I won't say it's grabbed me, but I will say it has my interest. So we'll see if it rivals the Poisonwood Bible in my opinion of Kingsolver's works.
That's the thing about novels, you know, that they, every once in a while you get one that just grabs you right out of the gate and you're like off to the races. And then there's some that you really need to read into a chapter or two before you really get pulled in. And I recommend folks out there, if you pick up a book and people tell you it's a great book and you read the first chapter and you're just not there, well, read another chapter, read maybe two more chapters, give it a fair shake. You might find that it'll really pull you in after you're into it.
Well, and your friend might even tell you that, might say, hey, stick with it for a little bit. But I think the thing I love about reading books that friends or people I know recommend is it gives me insight into my friends.
Well, what do the books I like tell you about me? Be careful. Yeah, I don't know.
That I worry for you and I pray for you, honey.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. Well, I thought what we do today, and since we're still lacking the ability to get people in to interview, that's going to change, as I said, you know, now that I got my phone fixed to Bluetooth in. You know, it's interesting. I was listening to another podcast. There's a podcast by Thomas Umstadt Jr. called Novel Marketing. And he did a podcast on podcasting recently, and he said that he doesn't interview anybody over the phone unless they have some high-end equipment on their end to make sure the sound is exact. I'm not going to be quite that hard line about it, at least at this point in my podcasting life. But I got to tell you, the sound with the phone Bluetooth through the system actually sounded pretty good. It's not as good as the microphones, but it's pretty good.
It's pretty good. Well, yeah, good.
It's pretty good.
Well, the quality of phones, I mean, my goodness, anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. So I thought what we do is I'm going to read a chapter out of my newest book, the one that's a nonfiction. It's called Loving Out Loud, Learning to Love in a Hate-Filled World, available on Amazon, both in ebook and paperback. And also, if you're interested in this after listening to this, there's also a companion workbook. So
I haven't seen that. Do you have any of those?
Yeah, I've got a couple here with me you can take a look at. But basically, there's a paperback copy and then there's a companion workbook. And so we actually, the two copies I have came because somebody thought they were buying the book and they bought the companion workbook by mistake.
Right. I remember that happening now.
Just make sure that you're a little bit careful there on which one you choose. But this book's designed to be used in small groups and Bible studies and things like that, as well as individual study. And that's where the companion workbook comes in, is for those group settings.
Nice. So
at any rate, what I thought I would do is read chapter one, give you a flavor of this book. And then Nancy, I've asked her to contemplate a question or two as I read. and we'll talk for a few minutes after I'm done with chapter one, and then we'll see how we wrap this thing up. So here we go. Chapter one of Loving Out Loud, Learning to Love in a Hate-Filled World. Chapter one, Christie's Friend, Meaningful Words in a Hurtful Tongue. Therefore, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any common sharing in the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion, then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and of one mind. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. Philippians chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. I wish I could invent a way to tie a string to the words I say, so that if I say something stupid, hurtful, or offensive, I could just pull them back in before anyone hears. If only I had a magic reset button that I could hit to erase the last 5 seconds, and I could start over. Have you ever felt that way? If I could invent either of those, I bet you'd buy them. I bet I'd become so rich that I could buy out Warren Buffett. Instead of the Oracle of Omaha, I'd be the Oracle of Indy. One day, not all that long ago, I was sitting in a class on Sunday morning at church when one of those moments came around. A friend of mine was sharing a lengthy comment on the subject we were discussing when all at once a horn began to sound outside. It kept going off while my friend continued to share. The two sounds conflicted for several more seconds. Finally, some of the guys jumped up to see what the noise outside was all about. As it turns out, it wasn't much of anything important, so everyone came back to their seats. Someone said everything was under control, but I said, I thought it was just someone trying to get my friend to stop talking. Folks laughed. I think my friend even laughed. He didn't seem to be overly bothered, but immediately I wished I had not spoken. I wished that I had the ability to reel the words right back in or hit the reset button. If only I could just hit backspace in real life. Words are powerful things. Words have consequences. Words can change things for good or ill. Think Lincoln and the Gettysburg Address. Think Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his I Have a Dream speech. Think Hitler in pre-World War II Germany. Good or ill. Words matter. That event from Sunday reminded me of a story from my days in the church youth group as a teen in Muncie, Indiana. I was probably a senior in high school at the time, and I was regarded as a leader among the teens. I should have known better than to do what I did. I was someone that the youth leader, Neil, had identified as a person with whom he would personally work to develop as an asset to the group. On an intellectual level, I understood that he loved and respected me, and that my teen group friends loved me as well. But often my insecurities took control. You see, at my core, I was deeply insecure in nearly all circumstances. It made me hypersensitive and even sometimes a little suspicious. Generally, I covered it up by trying to be funny. If I could make the other teens laugh, then I felt appreciated and liked. I sought to win the other teens' approval through their laughter. Usually, those attempts at humor were harmless, although I suspect they were likely quite obnoxious, too. Still, there was one time when I said something so horrible in an ill-fated attempt to provoke laughter that I still cringe when I think about it to this day. I really should have known better. It was Monday Night Fellowship. That was our youth group's weekly teen event. It was held at a different family's home each time we met. But I don't recall where we were that particular week. We all loved those nights together. We had so much fun playing games, singing songs, and learning from our youth minister's devotionals. We laughed and joked and cut up. I have so many memories from those days. Wow. That group made my teen years bearable. Monday Night Fellowship was also the one event where we could bring friends and be assured that they would have a good time. They could connect with our group, hear a message from Scripture in a relaxed atmosphere, and walk away encouraged. It was an outreach event for our group, and it wasn't uncommon for new kids to show up on any given Monday. On the Monday of my big mouth, Christy had brought a friend, a girl from her school. In general, I remember she was very friendly and outgoing and sort of cute. However, she had one rather prominent feature that was overtly apparent to everyone in the room. Fortunately, almost everyone had the good sense to keep their mouth and their thoughts to themselves. Almost everyone. Everyone but me. I had no good sense about me on that particular night. During the devotional, Neil, the youth minister, was sharing a message. I don't recall the overall gist, but in the message, we were asked to say something encouraging about someone else in the room. The point was to learn to build one another up in a positive way. In one incredible example of my own thick-headedness, I completely missed that point. Look around the room, he said. Share something encouraging about someone. Enter me and my personal insecurities blanketed in a need to be funny. I looked around for someone to share about. Simultaneously, my brain was working on some creative way to be funny, to make everyone laugh. It had taken that opportunity to build someone else up and converted it into an opportunity to ease those lingering insecurities, to build itself up. I spotted the cute, outgoing visiting girl with the prominent feature. She was sitting there, looking comfortable with the group, listening to the message, engaged, and enjoying the experience. With impeccable timing, I got everyone's attention, pointed, and said, "She has a big nose." Looking back, I just don't understand how I could say something like that. Why would I put the need to be funny so far ahead of any sense of common decency? Why would I even think that was funny? How could I be so hurtful? Was it some sort of twisted adolescent attempt at flirting? I am still ashamed of this very moment. The room went dead silent in shock for what seemed like eons, but was probably only about long enough for Neil to connect his brain to his mouth and say, "That was uncalled for. I don't want to hear anything like that from you ever again." My shame was immediate, deep, and deserved. For the rest of the evening, I withdrew into myself out of complete humiliation. I can't recall if I ever apologized. I sure hope I did. But that wouldn't have made the girl's pain and embarrassment any less. I had taken an innocent stranger and trampled on her for my own benefit. Here's the thing. I never saw that girl again. That, maybe, is the worst thing about what I did. My words severed the potential of relationships between that girl and our group and our church. Perhaps we could have been great friends, but my words spoiled it all. I had humiliated her. Who knows what lasting effects that event had? Who knows what the downstream consequences have been? Words are powerful. Words matter. In the Bible, in the book of James, the writer says, "Those who consider themselves religious and yet do not keep a tight rein on their tongues deceive themselves and their religion is worthless." James 1:26. That evening, I made my religion worthless. I traded the faith I believed in and the Lord I served for what I had hoped would be a few seconds of reassuring laughter. I wonder how often our religious words have a similar effect on folks as my thoughtless words had on that girl so many years ago. How often do we sever a person's connection to the church through our need to be right or our need to get our point across? How often do our flippant words disconnect people from our body of believers? Do we trade our faith in the deep wealth of opportunity that relationships hold for a few seconds of making our point? Obviously, from the story I told at the outset of this chapter, I've not yet mastered my mouth. Unfortunately, I still have a tendency to want the approval of others that can be found in their laughter, and that need comes out occasionally in a rather sharp, sarcastic manner. I'm a work in progress, but my highest goal these days is to use my words in meaningful ways, to help and not to harm, to build up and not to tear down. I like to think that I follow that positive course much more now than I did in my past. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. Ephesians 4:29. I was thinking about the story of my hurtful words recently while perusing the vast amount of words bantered around on Facebook and Twitter. This person hates that public figure. That person is standing up against that terrible social wrong, which someone else hatefully argues is a social right. There's another vulgar joke, another false accusation, another profanity-laced political rant against this group or that group. Many of the words are strong, but how many are truly meaningful and meant to build up rather than to tear down? How many are meant to show love to one another? You be the judge. If I had the chance today to stand in humility before that girl from so many years ago, I would tell her how sorry I truly am. May I never again have the need to apologize like that to anyone. But the chances are that I will. The key to any potential success I may have, though, is likely found in those words I shared from the outset of this chapter, the words from Philippians 2. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interest, but each of you to the interests of others. Passage is a description of biblical love, the unselfish nature of agape love put into practice. More and more as I grow in my love for others, my insecurities have less and less space to operate. If I had understood that concept more fully as a teen, perhaps I would have at least one more friend in my life today. Your words have power. Your words matter. Be meaningful, helpful, and encouraging to someone with your words every chance you get. You really can make a positive difference in someone's life. The world can be moved with strong, loving, meaningful words, yours and mine. Be mindful of your power, the power of agape love put into practice. And then I close the chapter out with a challenge. The challenge is, apologize to someone for something you should not have said. Also, go out of your way to say something encouraging. Build someone up with your words. And that is chapter one.
Well then.
What do you think, Nance?
I have a lot of thoughts on that. And it sparked even some new thoughts on it, you know, even related to our current situation and such. My first thought when you were talking about the first situation and joking around, I know that we've had friends over the years, and when you really have a relationship, obviously the teenage example that you gave, you really didn't know this girl at all.
No, I didn't. I never got the chance to.
Yeah. And sometimes there can be just in families, in friendships, in tight relationships, you kind of have that teasing, funning, poking at, and it's like, well, should I?
Yeah, it's actually, I think there's a fine line when it comes to that kind of a thing. You have to really be mindful of how, I think there's a point at which you go too far. One of your favorite things about me when I'm joking around saying stuff is I go one step too far
with that joke. One step
too far.
You were good until that last step.
Yeah. And those are just my own. Those are not against anybody or about anybody. Those are just my when I'm joking about something, I just take it one step too far. But I think that's the same thing with relationships. You can go too far. You can be bantering back and forth. And there's actually another chapter in the book that talks about that. It's the story of Todd, where we became friends in my first year of Bible college, and we used to banter back and forth, and we were always ripping at each other, and it was a lot of fun until it wasn't. And I have no idea where Todd is now.
It started wearing on you after a while. It wasn't fun anymore. It just started.
Yeah. Yeah, it stopped being funny, and it started kind of hurting, and then all of a sudden we just didn't hang out anymore. Mm-hmm. And now we're just I have no idea. I think he's in Ohio somewhere, but mm-hmm. I haven't talked to him in 40 years.
It's interesting how one use of words can really destroy a relationship or cause pain or hurt. And yet at the same time, one choice of words at an appropriate time can make a relationship.
Yeah. Well, like I got a phone call last night from my friend, Jim Brantley. Those of you listening out there, he's the father of Dr. Kent Brantley, who you may recognize his name. If you don't, then you can Google him. You can figure out who he is. But he's Jim's my friend, and I had written something that kind of stuck with him, and he called me just to check on me. And he goes, Mike, you can call me anytime, day or night. If you need to talk, you just give me a call.
It's nice.
Those kind of words help.
Because you believe him.
Yeah. Yeah. He was sincere. If I called him at 2 a.m., he would talk to me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I don't have any doubt about that. Those aren't empty.
Yeah.
Empty words hurt, but words that are sincere make a real difference. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So any other thoughts from that chapter?
Well, I think we have points that you made in the chapter that words matter, our rhetoric matters. I keep thinking, though, you've told me that story over the years, and I'm like, does she really have that big of a nose? I guess I see a variety of people, and I don't see, so I guess it was something that was very prominent to everyone since they all got quiet once you said that.
Yeah.
Was it really that way, or was it?
No, it was.
It was somewhat that way, but your comment made it.
No, it was a significant, large hook of a nose. I hesitate to answer your question, actually, because I on the outside, minuscule chance that she ever listens to this podcast, I'd hate to bring up pain for her. And I know there are people out there who have.
Well, and to be fair, people grow and develop at different times in different ways and physically and such. So, who knows? But I thought was it really your words and the awareness, it seems like, was what really.
Well, she was, my guess is, I mean, I've had my own things that I've been insecure about, physical aspects or whatever. We all have physical things and that you're.
There's times though that I have not had, but somebody's made a comment and then I had that uncomfortable feeling like, yeah. Okay, I'm out of sync here.
Yeah.
Because of that, and it sometimes.
Yeah. Well, I guess, it might've been, some of this might be my assumption, but. It was pretty prominent.
Do you think that the firm rebuke and kind of correction that you got from Neil, do you think that that was warranted?
Oh yeah.
In exactly that way in front of everybody.
Yeah. I humiliated that girl in front of everybody, and it was appropriate for him to humiliate me in front of everyone. I deserved it. I definitely deserved it.
Did he ever see you do that again? In that group?
No. No. I've over the years, I've obviously said things at different times where I wished I could reel them back in, but I have never done something like that.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
Whether Neil was there or not. It wouldn't have mattered whether Neil was in the room. And Neil, if you're listening point out taken. There, you spoke strongly to me, but it made a difference in my life.
Well, so. And it's funny too, because there can be different types of motivation that help you change. One of the things that I've learned in the gym that I go to is that sometimes people need to, come on, you can do it. You got this. And other times I'll never forget one time the owner walked by me and he's like, look, you're doing that wrong. You do it again. And I'm going to make you do 50 push-ups. And I did it perfect the next. So it was like, okay, fear motivates me, cause I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. But he has developed the sense to tell what motivates people in different ways. And there's times for the kind word. That's the other thing I got to thinking about as you were talking about it. In this world, sometimes in the culture we have had, we talk about everybody so sensitive. They're hypersensitive. Should we really consider all the people that we're talking to, consider what could be, because someone's going to argue, you could spend all your time worrying about what you say when you just need to speak truthfully and genuinely or what have you.
Well, I guess my thing would be that if we always strove to speak lovingly, we wouldn't have to worry about what we're saying. if we're
and what is focused, speaking lovingly?
If it feels like love to someone else, if it feels like love to the listener, then you're doing okay.
Yeah. That makes sense.
People use that as an excuse sometimes. I'm just telling them the truth. I'm telling them the truth in love, but it doesn't feel like love.
Right.
You know, it feels like hate. And I think there's a difference there.
For a while I was studying communications when I was in college. And one of the things that one of the professors said to me or said to the group, and it really stuck with me, was effective communication isn't you getting your message across, you know, you saying what you need to say. It's the hearer understanding what you're trying to communicate. And certainly the harsh word or the harsh joking, what you're communicating, you know?
Yeah.
And then you got into the part there where you're talking, it wasn't so much about harsh words, like an obvious faux pas, bad situation like you had. You were talking about how we have a tendency to have to get our piece out, have to say our part, have to give our opinion.
Right.
I thought about that because I thought, yes, that's been the way. But then I thought, you know, while we've been under this quarantine, under the COVID-19 quarantine, it seems like it's dropped a little bit. It's still out there.
Other things have taken the focus away. You know, the political rhetoric has died down because the focus on everything is on the COVID-19.
Yeah.
As soon as we start to come out of the other end of that and we come up on the election, it'll ramp back up. I've still seen it though.
I've still seen it. But it's interesting when you say that, because I had this afternoon a colleague of mine who he lives in Chicago, but I knew him when he came right out of college and watched him grow up through, you know, my organization. And he just reached out to me. He goes, "Hey, I was just flipping through my phone and I saw you and wanted to check in and see how you're doing. I'm trying to reach out to people who are important to me," which that was precious to me that he felt that way. But one of the things we were talking about is that we hope that through this scenario, change happens to our culture. Mm-hmm. And that it isn't so much an issue of some of these things are not politics anymore, but they do become a little bit more data to support some moral thoughts. Because we were talking about, he was very concerned. His parents and his sister all have what we would call essential jobs, where they're paid, you know, little more than minimum wage. And yet they have to go in, and two of them work for an organization that they normally wear masks, but they gave theirs all up for the hospital. So they're going to work not wearing masks. So he's very concerned about his family and them being exposed or being in a more unsafe scenario by what they're doing. And yet they are lower wage workers. And so it does become kind of a question of, well, what are we doing? Not everything's equal. Not everything's fair in the world. But those kinds of data points make you wonder about, well, what do you say about something like that? Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we'll come out the other end of this thing and we'll have a better feel for what's important in life. Mm-hmm. And maybe making all of our points isn't as important as actually caring about the person.
Yeah. I struggle with that.
In what way?
Getting the point across. So, number one, I struggle with interrupting. I'm doing pretty good today, but if you're struggling with and you interrupt people a lot, in my mind, and maybe this isn't you, but for me, what's going on in my head is I'm hear what they say, I'm processing it, and I've got to tell them my point about what they've shared with me instead of just really sitting back, relaxing that brain and listening. Well, they always say you have two ears and one mouth, so you should listen twice as much as you talk.
I've spent my career, my professional career in sales. Uh-huh. And one of the things that salesmen fight with all the time, and it's in every training class we ever have, is to listen more than you talk and to not come up with your answer while you should be listening. And that's a key thing there. But hopefully some of the rhetoric will be a little lighter coming out of this, and we'll be more concerned about loving one another.
It's not going to be perfect. We're still going to have stuff going on there and opposing views and people, one person thinking the other person is absolutely wrong in their perspective. But it's one thing that I hope the thing I take from this chapter for me is every single time I'm in that situation with a group of friends and I just blurt out, well, why is it that way? Or no, there's a difference between this and that. And, you know, we're having a conversation and it's not even harsh or an attack on them, but it's like, stop. Well, why do you think that's important? Tell me your understanding of what you're saying there. Tell me more.
Right.
Tell me more, you know?
Right.
Because then I'm really going to understand the person next to me and perhaps make different decisions.
Okay. Well, we have been going here for a little bit. Wasn't sure it was going to go this long, but here we are. Do you have one of those questions for me that you formulated last time? If you do, okay, hold that thought, because I'm going to wrap up this and then we'll go to that question.
Okay.
Folks, you know, the book that I just read out of is my latest book. It's called Loving Out Loud, Learning to Love in a Hate-Filled World. I hope that chapter gave you a taste of what that book is all about. It is, every chapter is chock full of actual real life people, real life situations. And it either shows how someone else really gave me an example of really incredible love, or it's like this chapter where I really, really blew it. But hopefully in each of them, it gives you a message, a lesson learned, that you can translate into your own, life experiences. And like I said, it's really good. It's really useful for small groups, Bible study groups, reading groups, and it does have that companion workbook. So with that, done with that part. So what's your question?
Well, I'm going to say one thing before I give you my question.
Okay.
I will say that I highly endorse and love this book. And one of the things that I love about it is your vulnerability. Because I think I even asked you, are you prepared to put out there? Because you share examples about how you really blew it.
Well, this is a good example.
This is a good example. And so that opens you up. That makes you vulnerable. And I love that because I think that's where we hit. There's a freedom in being able to be vulnerable with one another. And I think that the examples and the stories that you provide in the book help people see that. Now, it's also, I will say, it's very scary to be vulnerable and just completely open in who you are with someone else. But to get real depth in a friendship, you have to, right? Mm-hmm. So that's my two cents on that little piece there.
Thanks.
So, question this week.
Okay.
You are stranded on a desert island.
Stranded on a desert island with you?
No.
Oh.
All by yourself.
By myself.
You don't even have Wilson the volleyball with you.
Oh, no Wilson. Okay.
You can have one book and one book only with you that you can read over and over to entertain yourself. What book would that be?
For entertainment.
Well, to entertainment, keep your sanity.
Well, the easy answer, at church, the answer to every question is Jesus. It would about have to be a classic, you know, something with depth and history.
Okay.
You're
a better person than me.
it's gotta be something that has, a life to it, you know, something that can translate across time and ages, because some books are very entertaining, but they're so based on current events and current things that they don't translate over the long haul. So I guess it would have to be something like that. I don't think I'd want it to be my usual
go-to. Or one of those scary, yucky books. Yeah,
Stephen King is out on this one. I don't want Stephen King on it. I don't even want Bram Stoker or Mary Shelley. I don't want one of those classics either.
Not for over and over. No, and that's not the for only
over
thing.
And over and over and over again. Boy. This is hard. Do you have one?
I have what I would say maybe two.
Okay, let me hear yours and maybe it'll help me.
Okay, one of them I say, obviously my favorite book has been the Poisonwood Bible.
Right.
Just because of the story it tells, the characters, the way that each chapter, she writes it from like a different person's view in the family, but she doesn't tell you that. Over time, you recognize, oh, this is Susie or this is John or what have you, because of the style of how it's written, which I just find that to be beautiful, entertaining, and anything that involves, you know, people and relationships and how it develops and intertwines. I connect with that. So I would say I would be okay with that one. Then I would probably say one of the Outlander books. And again, it's because
just one or the whole series.
Well, if you had, it would be fun. I would say probably the second book in the series, because there's like eight of them. Plus there's a bunch of some novellas off of the side of them too. But Diana Gabaldon, she's another one who has writing that is, it's just very rich in layers. It's not the first one really sets the story, and there's some things in the first one that I enjoy, and it involves time travel and all this kind of thing. And, you know, there's some things in it that I don't like in the whole series aspect. That's life. When you're dealing with people in life, there's some things I don't particularly care about, but I feel like I connect, or when I read, I don't read your scary stories. I tend to read at night right before I go to bed. And I do it just to relax my brain and disconnect from the day. So I can't, before I go to bed, read like a self-help book or like the Bible, something that's going to get my mind thinking and analyzing. And I can't do that. That's not going to make me go to sleep. So I read novels that take me completely out of today. And I especially like historical fiction. So where they take, and it's a fictional story, but it's in a actual historical time period that I know about, or I can relate to and stuff. So I would probably say, one of those. I'd probably be okay with any of them in the series, 'cause I could remember from other books from the series how the relationship connected or how they got here or there. But the second book I think was one that really resonated or solidified those characters for me.
Okay. Well, I'm going to demand that I have a whole series. If I'm going to be locked on an island for an indefinite period, and I only, you know, I need something to read.
Yeah.
I'm going to demand, since I'm making the rules here.
Oh, yeah, I thought they were my rules, but go ahead. Well, go ahead and mansplain it to me.
I'm going to. No.
Just teasing.
I'm not mansplaining, I promise. I would want, let me just request then.
Okay, sure. So if you had a series, what series would you have?
I'm going to go with the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Really?
That's along with The Hobbit.
That got some deep, dark stuff in it.
It does, but it takes you somewhere, and there's so many layers and depth and relationships.
See, I could get that with the, what's the Ranger's Apprentice series?
Yeah.
That's, young adult series, if even adults.
That's middle grade. That's
middle grade. Yeah. Okay. Even adults, if you've not read the Ranger's Apprentice series by Flanagan, great.
It's a great series. Great. In fact, series. I need to get the next copy. I need to get the next book. I think I've read 9 of them. I need to get the next one.
Yeah. Highly recommend.
Yeah. So I think that's what I would, either that or the Chronicles of Narnia series. One of those two, because they're timeless. They have lasted over the generations, and they take you somewhere, and there are lots of depth and layers in there. So that's I think what I would go for.
Okay.
All right, folks. Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Cutter's Notch podcast. Please, if you get a chance, I'd be really neglectful of my daughter's wishes if I didn't remind you that you can give us a review. If you could take the time to review this podcast on whatever system you listen to the podcast on, that would be appreciated. It helps to us to be established out there and for people to see that it's something that they should listen to. So if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a review. Again, my books are available on Amazon, and I will catch you next time on the Cutter's Notch podcast.
The Cutter's Notch podcast can be found through any podcast listing provider. New episodes will drop approximately twice per month. Connect with Michael at the following email address: authormichaeldecamp@gmail.com. Again, that's authormichaeldecamp@gmail.com. Abandon Hope, a Cutter's Notch novel, can be purchased as an ebook, paperback, or hardcover through any bookstore, both online and local. Get your copy and start your own Cutter's Notch adventure today.